Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 15th. It's a Monday, the year 2002. And today's session, or this session, is presented by Susan and Michael Thomas in their series Gates to the Holy City, People and Land. It's a session one, and it's entitled Jaffa Gate, Entry and Accomplishing Accompaniment. So, let's go listen to these two on this presentation.
This is a song that many of us have learned using the Hebrew word shalom, which means both hello and goodbye in common usage, but also peace and really the really full and deep peace of God that brings reconciliation between God and humankind and human and human. The Arabic word salam actually means virtually the same thing. And so I'd like us to learn a song that functions in some of the way that the Shalom, my friend song, functions for the Arabic-speaking world and is well known by Palestinian Christians. And the words are, Yar Abba Salami, Amter Aleina Salam. Want to try that?
Yar Abba Salami, Amter Aleina Salam.
Then the second line is Yar Abba Salami in la Kulubina Salam.
Yar Abba Salami in la Kulubina Salam.
And the meaning, of course, is God of peace, rain peace upon us, fill our hearts with peace. This first verse. And it goes like this.
Yar Abba Salami, Amter.
But also in our congregation. This is an introduction to our congregation. We are Michael and Susan Thomas, and we are pastors of the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer of the English-speaking congregation in the Old City of Jerusalem. And every Sunday we sing this during the passing of the peace. But we are not alone. Also, we know of at least one synagogue in Jerusalem where this is also sung, and that their prayers in Arabic for peace. And the congregation has taken upon itself intentionally every week to pray for peace, to sing for peace in Arabic. Let me ask two questions. First of all, how many of you were here last week and attended any sessions? Okay. On Friday, right? Okay. And the slides we are showing and the emphasis that we have on some of the days is slightly different than we had last week. So if you had come last week, you will see new slides and have slightly different experience, I think, of the class. Let me also ask you, how many of you have traveled to Jerusalem or to the Holy Land, to the Middle East? Can you raise your hands? So about maybe a sixth, seventh of the group. And so we would like to draw into the discussion both those of you who have traveled to the Holy Land and those of you who have yet travel there. And one of the things that we want to mention very clearly is that this is an especially important time, perhaps not an especially safe time, but an especially important time for Christians to travel to the Middle East, to travel to Israel and Palestine, to visit both Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, and Palestinian Christians, Palestinian Muslims, and also to, we hope, to visit internationals as well, because we need your visit also. Okay. There are resources here that I invite you to come up and look at. Afterwards, Barbara Rossing has emphasized that we really should push, or maybe it was Janet, we should really push this book because it's hardbound and it's... it's the normal price for a hardbound book. It's $30. But it's a good book. It's written by a Boston, native-born Boston Irish Catholic named Charlie Sennett, who was the Boston Globe correspondent in Jerusalem. And he covered New York City as a young reporter, and that's where he learned his reporting skills. And he believes that if you can cover New York City, if you can cover the urban beat, you can cover anywhere in the world, especially hot spots. You find out who the cops are, who they're chasing, why, and you're well on to your story. And he tells a very compelling story of the journey that Jesus made from Galilee and northern Israel south to Jerusalem. And it covers up to about November of 2000, through November 2000.
December.
Of 2000. And as I mentioned, he is a reporter. We are pastors, and that's the perspective that we bring to the discussions this week. We're not archaeologists or historians or political scientists. We hope we have some acquaintance so we can be in conversation, but we'll primarily present a pastoral view of our presence, our life with Palestinian Christians, especially Palestinian Lutheran Christians. Also, in the bookshop, there's a really helpful issue of the link, which is published by the American for Middle East Understanding. There's a kind of primer. It's more than really a style sheet on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict by J. Martin Bailey, who's a UCC pastor. He was also at one time president of our church congregation and is a communicator. So I invite you to look at that. Also, Fred Stricker, who will be helping us with this presentation today a little later on, has a book that you did the photographs of, on Bethlehem. On Bethlehem 2000. And that's also in the bookstore. And that will show you what Bethlehem was like year 2000. And some people are already talking, we need to have another Bethlehem 2003 now to begin to repair the damage that has been done in the last year.
Fred's book, that book, Bethlehem 2000, was written together with the author of this book, which is also available in the bookstore, Mitri Raheb, Lutheran pastor in Bethlehem. It's just an excellent introduction to what it is to be Palestinian and Christian, which at the time he wrote this, and maybe still, didn't seem to go together in many people's minds, the idea being both that. There is also going to be, during this month, it's actually during July, the Lutheran, isn't it? The July Lutheran magazine has many excellent articles on the situation in the Middle East. And Gloria Strickert has kindly gone to get a copy of one of them, which is an interview with Rosemary Radford Ruther, who wrote the introduction to this book and is a liberation theologian here in the United States, an interview with her, and it gives a lot of kind of basic information about what is helpful to know about this situation for you to be able to understand why we maybe have gotten some odd ideas about what's going on there. And I also want to point out that we are just getting together now some resources we brought with us. This is a little box. We'll put it in the resource center or on the peace table. This is a little box that has newspapers, full copies of newspapers, and from the Israeli press, especially the Haaretz newspaper, which has done an excellent job of covering the conflict in most cases. Also, a copy of the Jerusalem Post recently and a copy of the Jerusalem Report, a magazine. So those are kind of full copies to peruse at your leisure. And then there will be a box that I'm working on over there of clippings and other articles. If you get a chance to look at throughout the week, you may find interesting.
And we will need the articles back because we'll be taking them with us to Minnesota.
Oh, and one more thing. I'm wearing a little cross here on a thread, and I invite you to take one. It's an olive wood cross made in Bethlehem, bought in Jerusalem, and it has a little hole drilled in so you can put it on a thread if you'd like to wear it this week or sometime, but it would be a memory for you of your time here at Holden this week.
And then one last resource that unfortunately has not yet arrived, and we will certainly lift it up when it does arrive, we hope in the next day or so, Through the Eyes of the Victim, which is written by a Palestinian Christian, a colleague in ministry of ours in Jerusalem, Alex Awad. We'll mention that as soon as it comes into the bookstore. Let me just say, before we begin, some slides that are going to be a kind of entree into the life of Palestinian Christians and our life in Jerusalem and in the West Bank and Israel. Let me say that this may sound one-sided, and if you hear it as a one-sided presentation, you probably have heard it correctly. But during the week, I think we will talk a little bit about our involvement and engagement both with American Jews and Israeli Jews in this conflict. Let me say also that were the situation reversed, if the Palestinians had power and used it the way that the Israelis used their power on Palestinians, if it was reversed, we would be also protesting that abuse of power, that kind of oppression, as I hope, I pray as strongly as we are trying to lift up the need for a re-examination of the situation and to lift up the possibility of peace and justice in the Middle East. And it is indeed complex, but a little later in the week we're going to talk about Beit Jala, a neighboring village to Bethlehem where there is a Lutheran church and orphanage. And that was the Israelis came in August of 2001 one and took over the school for about and the church compound for about 24 hours. And world attention, especially from international Lutherans, was able to be directed on that situation, and it changed in 24 hours. The Israelis left. It was because it was a very clear and compelling case that this was an unjust action. And I want to make the argument that we can present a clear and compelling case that what the Israelis are doing is also unjust. It is indeed complex, just the way that when we use our eyes, when we think of the neural connections between our eyes and our brains, we know that there's a great deal of complexity. But nonetheless, what we receive in the midst of that complexity is clarity in terms of clearness of vision. And we hope that we can present some clarity. So let's begin with the slide. Could I ask you to stand up, and on the top of the machine, there is an obvious knob that needs to be depressed. And our entree point today is going to be Jaffa Gate. It's the gate. If you come as a pilgrim to Jerusalem, it's most likely the gate that you will first enter the old city through. And that's our entree point as well to the Palestinian Lutheran Church, its members. And let me just remind all of us that what we're talking about is peace in the Middle East. Let me stand, see if I can stand over here and stand out of the way. People, this is from a church retreat we had at a community called Neve Shalom, which is also has the same name and in Arabic the same meaning, a village of peace in Israel. Where Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews live together, not just simply tolerate each other, but live together in community. And each session we're going to begin with this map, which is a mosaic. It's slightly larger than life size here, but it's part of a much larger mosaic. This is a facsimile in the Old City of Jerusalem that was presented for educational purposes, and it's part of a much larger mosaic that was discovered in 1896. It had lay covered for about 12 centuries in the town of Madaba in present-day Jordan. It's just east of the Dead Sea. And the mosaic itself is about the size of this room. And about two-thirds of it is still readable as a topography of the Middle East. It is a Christian map, though. It is a map that presents Jerusalem at the center and the place from which the tradition says that Jesus was crucified and buried and rose from the dead. Namely, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Resurrection is right here. And it's upside down. You would go in through the up some steps and through these three entrances into the large church. And just to locate you, using this map that's 13 centuries old, almost 14 centuries old, the Church of the Redeemer is about right here. So we're talking about the city of Jerusalem and the old city, the walled city of Jerusalem, with the Dome of the Rock, which dates back also to the 7th century. Beautiful building, and that's what we see every morning when we wake up and look out our window and watch the sun comes from behind us from the east and shines into the old city, first striking the Dome of the Rock and the Church of the Redeemer Tower.
This is the area of the old city where the temple would have been at the time of Jesus.
Now we're at Jaffa Gate. We're looking through Jaffa Gate. It was opened at the end of the 19th century in response to the upcoming visit of the Kaiser Wilhelm from Prussia. And this lion over there is part of a whole series of current art in Jerusalem. It's a little bit like the cows in Chicago or Switzerland. So they have lions everywhere, and individual artists were invited to decorate the lion. So there's one lion that has a cage around it. This lion is armor-plated, is covered with armor. In much the way that the Crusaders, when they came, also had armor. These two crusaders, so to speak, are just outside of Jaffa Gate. And despite stringent security in the old city, there are still people attempting to climb the walls or are climbing the walls because of the frustration of life there. And this, again, is the entrance to Jaffa Gate with a line of cars that are being searched. Internationals and Israeli Jews can go right through. Palestinians will be stopped. They'll be asked for their identification, for their car registry, and often the trunks will be searched as well. Might be just a little too far from this. I'm going back. And this is David's citadel that these figures are climbing. It's also part of an art exhibit. This is our entree, as I mentioned, to the Palestinian Lutheran Church through Jaffa Gate. It's the gate we enter when we drive. And we work very closely with Bishop Muneeb Yunan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan. It has that name because where we are standing, namely in the Church of the Redeemer, when the church was founded in 1957, this was Jordan. So it has a royal charter from this nation of Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan. And it's no easy thing to change a royal charter. And so I think as the Palestinian Lutheran Church is waiting for the dust to settle, and then they will have a name change that reflects their presence in Palestine and also in Israel and Jordan.
Michael said 1957 as the beginning of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, but the Lutheran presence in the Holy Land is much older, beginning in the 1840s with a European bishop that was shared with the Anglican Church and the Prussian Church at that point.
This is a gathering in Bethlehem. I know Barbara said not to have too many internationals in the photograph.
That's
so,
all right.
So please just ignore the one on the left. This is a family that means a lot to the church and has been very good at both singing, conveying, writing, showing what it means to be a Palestinian Christian. This is Mitri Raheb, his sister Viola, and his mother Mrs. Raheb. They live in the oldest part of Bethlehem, and we're going to talk a little bit about Viola in just a moment.
So this is taken in Bethlehem.
And this is in Major Square, Pentecost 2000. We had envisioned a large gathering of Christians from around the world to join us in celebration on Pentecost 2000. And this is in the square as we left the Bethlehem Peace Center. And it's a wonderful gathering of both Palestinians and international Christians. And this is what happened just 2 years ago. 2 years later, there were Israeli tanks in this square, and they were occupying the building that we just worshipped in, the Bethlehem Peace Center, which was a gift of the Swedish government to the people of Bethlehem. We now go to Amman, Jordan. Why do we go to Amman? Because Viola Rahab, the woman that was just pictured a moment ago, fell in love with a Palestinian who lived in Vienna because he couldn't live in the West Bank. He was a Palestinian refugee who grew up in Lebanon, educated at Presbyterian schools, and now he is a classical air musician in Vienna, performing throughout Europe. And so we're at the Church of the Good Shepherd in Amman, Jordan. That's the pastor, Samir Azar. And the wedding is about to begin. And they could not get married. The Israelis not only wouldn't allow her husband to live in Palestine, on the West Bank, they also wouldn't allow the wedding to take place in Bethlehem. So it's taking place in Amman. Now, the wonderful thing about this wedding, though, is that for the first time, it was a kind of huge family reunion. Not that there were so many people there. I'm told that if the wedding had taken place in Bethlehem, the church, the Christmas Lutheran Church, which is not such a large church, would not only have been packed, but people would have gone all the way down to the Church of the Nativity trying to celebrate and participate in the wedding. Here there are about 160 people. But what's significant is that they're family members that have never met until this day. They've never met until this day because some live in Haifa, some live in Jerusalem, some live in Beirut, some live in Bethlehem, some live in Ramallah, and there are not connections between all those cities. So it was also a family reunion in addition to a wedding. And unlike a wedding that probably, if the wedding could have taken place in Bethlehem, there probably could not have been the celebration of the dance following at this time. And so it was really nice that at this wedding there was also a celebratory meal and dance.
Viola has been the director of the ELCJ schools, and these schools have been extremely important in the ministry and mission of the Lutherans in Palestine and Israel. They have been the place where Christianity is exemplified, especially with contact to the Muslim population as well, and they are places where attitudes of tolerance are taught in the curriculum itself, and it's been a very important contribution to the society as a whole, and a very important witness as Christians, those schools. And now that Viola has married someone who cannot live in the Holy Land, live in Palestine, Israel, she is going to have to relocate in Vienna, and this is breaking her heart, as well as the heart of many people who have been involved with her. I just want to mention, she had written an article about the identity and the future of Christians in the Holy Land, and just pointed to several challenges that Christians have there. And I just want to read these challenges. They are challenged in terms of number because they've been such a minority group, Christians within an overwhelmingly dominant Muslim culture now, and also Jewish culture in Israel. They've been challenged in terms of being a diverse community because the Christians in the area are coming from so many different cultural traditions, Armenian, Syrian, Greek, and Arab, and also four church families that represent especially the Orthodox Christian presence in the Middle East, and the Roman Catholic and the Oriental, as well as the Protestant. They've been challenged in terms of being in fellowship with the worldwide church, and at the same time rooted in their 1,400 years of history in the Arab Islamic culture. So they have this kind of a challenge. They've been challenged by the danger of emigration, which she has pointed to in this article, and now is finding herself in that same quandary and difficult decision. Because so many Christians who are Palestinian have left the area. They've been challenged by the increasing polarization of society into the very rich and the very poor, not much of a middle class, and that's where the Christians have generally been because they've been more educated as a generalization, and it's being more, well, now it's becoming more and more just poor in the Palestinian population, but they've been challenged by fundamentalist groups, whether they are Islamic, Jewish, or Christian, and she mentions it's important to notice in the Christian sector that most of that influence is actually foreign rather than indigenous to the Christians there. And they have been challenged by the volatile political situation, of course. So those kinds of challenges faced by Lutherans of all Christians are important to keep in mind for life there.
Let me just mention, once again, we serve an international English-speaking congregation. We're called by the Division for Global Mission to accompany, to work with, to partner with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, the Palestinian Lutheran Church. And the way that we primarily assist them is by pastoring an English language congregation, because that is a task they cannot take on at this time. Perhaps later they'll be able to take this task on. We also work closely with Bishop Meade. This is a farewell gathering, a farewell luncheon at our church a little bit more than a year ago. We have tremendous transition. We're going to talk more about the congregation later in the week, but suffice to say, we did a university or campus ministry where we had sort of a four-year transition period. Then we did ecumenical ministry in Vienna, Austria, and the transition was probably about 3 years. And the transition speed in Jerusalem was probably about 2 years. Now it has speeded up a lot. Oops.
Question?
Yeah, I'm curious about the number of Christians, percentage-wise.
What would you guess?
I'd guess less than 5%.
You're right. How much less?
About 2.
2%. Then.
2, okay. 2 is generally what people have said, both in Israel and in Palestine.
Right.
As 1.8, 1.5. Right now we are facing a huge hemorrhage of Christians because the areas, these three towns, Bethlehem, Beit Jala, and Beit Zahur, which are close to Jerusalem, are traditionally Christian towns, and they have been ones which have experienced the incursions, along with other Palestinian areas, but they have experienced incursions, and many people are now choosing to emigrate who are Christian.
Do they see the Christians as neutral, both sides, or?
No, I don't think so. Not generally. Neutral meaning what?
Neutral meaning do not showing favoritism to either side?
No.
We're going to talk about that later in the week.
Yeah. Fine.
The image that we'd like to use maybe is of leaven or of mustard seed. How can leaven be neutral? and we'll talk about the role that Christian Palestinians play, the really significant role. And it, the percentage of Christians in that society is very low. It was about 13%, I've read, about a century ago. Though there was an immigration outflow of Palestinian Christians even before 1948, and now the percentage is very small. And in perhaps a generation or two, the percentage will be so small that in terms of demography, they will be listed in other. They will not even be listed as Christians. They will be listed as others, 0.5%, 0.03%.
What part does economics play in the immigration of Christians?
Well, I think a large part.
We had a guy when we were there who was a Palestinian Christian, and even in those days, which are much different than today, he had a very difficult time supporting his family because of all the unrest and problems of the visitors not coming as many as they did at one time.
I mean, you certainly must have visited Bethlehem.
Yes.
That's a city that its main industry is tourism and related to commerce, making olive wood nativity sets and so on. And now that city is essentially shut down. There's not a hotel or a hospice or guest house open in that city. Let me just mention, to just speak about the rapidity of turnover, Susan and I are in the center of this photograph taken on our rooftop, and we're the only ones there. The picture's it's a little more than a year old, and people leave quickly is the message, most people. And we're going to come back and talk later in the week about the Christian Peacemaker team. They're Mennonite and Roman Catholic and Presbyterian and Methodist and even Wartburg graduates, as Leon Clausen on the far right. And they're a very important part of our congregation. They are 11 in our congregation. They are a witness for peace and justice in our congregation, and we are blessed to have them. And so they have become an important part of our family. And they turn over too quickly, every 3 months. And what's especially significant is the I think rising sense among church leaders of the importance for strong, courageous, nonviolent action. This is taken this past New Year's Eve. These are some of the church leaders of Jerusalem. They are leading a march from Bethlehem to the checkpoint with the intention of being able to walk through that checkpoint into Jerusalem. And they were stopped. They couldn't do it. And so we had a short prayer service, including some Muslim prayers. But I think the day is coming that those church leaders will not stop with a prayer service, but they will sit down and pray, and they will not move until they are arrested. And they have, I don't know that they've reached that point, but I'm sure that that point is coming.
What is the distance between Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Armon? I mean, geographically.
Okay. Bethlehem is just south of Jerusalem. In fact, there used to be a distance between them in terms of municipal boundaries. Now the boundaries adjoin one another. And what would you say, 5 miles? I mean,
five
if you go from the center,
center,
from the old city to the old city of Bethlehem, maybe 8 miles.
No, it's not that much.
Not that far.
And then where you live is?
We live just outside. We live across the Kidron Valley from the old city of Jerusalem.
On the Mount of Olives.
On the western slope of the Mount of Olives.
So geographically,
we're less than a mile from where we work.
In that town.
We're in East Jerusalem.
East Jerusalem. Yeah. So,
and Amman in Jordan is also only in normal times, like a 2 hour drive? Yeah, two-hour drive from Jerusalem to Amman, Jordan, in these days.
If you could drive.
If you could, yeah.
And this is, again, a picture of the same march with Mitri Rahab in the center and Bishop Meneve in the lower left-hand corner. And I just sense an increased willingness to take risk and nonviolent action.
And Pastor Jadala Shahada.
Oh, yes. Yes, to the right. And he is pastor of the Church of the Reformation in Beit Jala. And along with and behind, it's important to state where we stood, behind the church leaders of Jerusalem, our internationals that are there working with Christians, working with Muslims. Some are part of something called the International Solidarity Movement. And we're going to come back and talk about what's going to be called the accompaniment program sponsored by the World WCC, World Conference of Churches.
World Council
thinking
of Churches.
In German.
Okay. Okay. Well, German, thinking in German, great.
Okay, anyway.
But the accompaniment model, the idea of walking with the people who, the local church there, is the paradigm that the Lutheran Church, the ELCA, now uses for its mission. It always works with and through, whenever possible, the local Christian community and in the Holy Land, that we especially then work with the Lutheran Church. Sometimes the Division for Global Mission will work with other denominations as well, but a local expression of the church. And so they use as this paradigm the story of Jesus walking to Emmaus with the two disciples on the day of the resurrection, where they don't recognize him, you know, he's risen, and he kind of joins them as they're walking away, the two disciples, from Jerusalem. And they have this conversation along the way, and eventually, when he breaks bread with them, they realize who he is and that he's risen, and then they run back to Jerusalem. But the important, there are many important parts of that story that the mission idea uses, but the idea that Jesus is there in the center walking, and maybe the Lutheran Church from the United States is over here, and the Lutheran Church from Jerusalem and Jordan is here, and they were all walking together with Jesus in the center.
And that model, which is a relatively recent origin, is now beginning to have some effect. So, for instance, when the World Council of Churches began to envision in conversation with Palestinian Christians how they could partner with, how they could assist the movement towards justice in the West Bank, the model that was eventually chosen, the term that was eventually chosen, was accompaniment. It's not an E, it doesn't flow off the tongue, but it's an appropriate and good choice. And during our week, we're going to be talking about barriers, about checkpoints. This was a checkpoint on the way to Ramallah. And we're going to be reminded over and over again of the barriers that face anyone that wants to work for justice and peace in the Middle East. The challenges are always present and always call for great, great patience. And the Palestinian people have shown enormous patience, I think. And so, despite the fact of the suicide bombings, which I'm sure we will talk about, you have to understand this enormous patience that's a kind of resistance. Now, it's not the kind of resistance where the church leaders of Jerusalem will stop at the checkpoint between Bethlehem and Jerusalem and demand that they be arrested because they are not going to move. It's the kind of patience and resistance where Palestinian workers will go to enormous efforts to make it to work, not only because their family, because they need to earn their daily bread, but because it's a kind of act of resistance. It's saying to the Israelis, you may enclose us, you may encircle us, but you will not stop me from carrying out my daily trade, my work. And that it's really moving to see, as we've seen now. Now it has changed because it's even tighter. But there's a place called Tontur, an ecumenical research center, just next to the checkpoint between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, where Palestinian men and women would come through by the hundreds, somewhere between 800 and 2,000 a day, because they knew that they were welcome to come through that Catholic Research Center on their way to Jerusalem to find work or to sell vegetables. And they would come through, and the Israeli military police would be on the other side sometimes, waiting to catch them and to send them back or put them in jail. And so it's really moving. I notice, I don't know what the average age in this room is, but I'm sure it's over 40. It's really moving to see people our age running with vegetables on their head or their work tools, running away from the police so that they can maybe get into a neighborhood where they won't be seen and where they can find work, where someone will say, please come and paint my living room. And it's about church leaders that are beginning to take more and more risk, more and more clarity in issuing a call for justice. Here's Bishop Muniz. We're on our way to Ramallah, and he's arguing with the soldiers about being allowed to cross at this checkpoint. He has permission. The officer in charge of the area gave Bishop Muniz permission to cross, but the soldiers on site are saying, no, it means nothing. Go back. And he's saying, no, I'm not going back. And call your commanding officer. And eventually, he and our small delegation is allowed through. So it's about challenging these barriers. It's about choosing between whether you're going to accept the barriers razor wire and sandbags. This is at an Israeli military site in the city of Hebron, south of Jerusalem. Whether you're going to accept that kind of reality that's going to always encircle and enclose and limit you, or whether you're going to trust in the Christian vision, the vision of the cross, the following the cross. And this is a picture. This is actually a picture of a picture taken by a member of our congregation when we were pastors in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a woman, Brigitte Ralston, who came to visit us in Jerusalem several times. This is on Good Friday. It's the day that we follow the cross literally in Jerusalem, in the way that you do as well in your own communities. And as Brigitte was walking with our small group, as shop owners and people selling bread were just beginning to open up at about 6:30 in the morning, she comes around the corner and she sees this cart with two trays in the Greek letter tau, the sign of the cross there. And that's the end of the slide presentation, but it's clearly what we want to do is present a choice between accepting the barriers of injustice, the rocks of hatred, and the way of following the cross despite the cost, but also the great vision of peace, of shalom, of salam in this land.
I hope that you read the kiosk that said this session was going to go until 12, because this last half hour we've invited Fred Stricker to give a presentation using some overhead from that.
Do you want to pause first? Is there any questions?
How much time do you need?
An hour and a half.
An hour and a half. This is a very
it'll reach through, but we have to be careful on one.
Okay.
How large is your congregation?
It was about 100, and
three
then it was obviously many times we had big groups of pilgrims coming, you know, Lutherans from Ohio or Pennsylvania, other people who would come to the worship, and so we'd have some wonderful crowded worship on Sunday and a nice group of people throughout the week. Now we are probably looking at a regular congregation, a core congregation of about 35 or 40.
They're English speaking, so from what walks of life do they come? How is it that this group of English speakers
why they're there.
People are together, yeah.
Most people are there. They might be students. They might be taking a sabbatical if they're teaching in academia. They might be there to work with various non-governmental organizations. Most of the people in our congregation are actually working in the Palestinian sector in terms of economy or human rights, or are diplomats but are relating more with the Palestinians.
You know, they work day in and day out with Palestinians. They're really no students now. It's impossible for any institution to take on the liability of organizing a group to come to Jerusalem or Israel or the West Bank. And so we hope that we'll have a few academics. We hope that Barbara Rostig and Lauren might come over in the fall, Fred. But really, there are no students. There used to be a significant student component to the congregation. Now it's people that are working, we'll talk more about the congregation later in the week. Let me just mention what we didn't mention. At the Church of the Redeemer, which was founded by the Germans in the mid-19th century, there's a German-speaking congregation, which is also very small, about the same size as ours now. There's the Arabic-speaking Palestinian Lutheran congregation, which really anchors the church, and there's also a very small, it's really almost disappeared, a Danish student congregation. The Danish young people that were there were mostly volunteers, mostly in Israel. So they were bringing another side of the street, another perspective to the life of the church. And also the church offices of the ELCJ are located at Redeemer.
So Bishop Redeemer's office is there.
Okay. Well, I'm going to run through a bunch of maps just to help you kind of visualize. You know, we talked about checkpoints and relationship of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and we talked about terms like the West Bank and talk about settlements and all these kind of things, and to try to put that in some kind of perspective. And the other thing, a lot of times when I give talks, I have colleagues that often say, well, you know, they've always been fighting over there, and it's never going to get settled. And not really. I mean, there have been wars throughout history, just as there's wars everywhere. But it's not like it is today. I mean, sometimes that's kind of throwing up hands, like, forget it. We're not going to solve it. Let's just forget about it. But, you know, the message is people got along at one time, and what has happened in the 20th century can be reversed, and there can be solutions. And so the first map I have up here is from the Ottoman Empire, which, of course, was the time Ottomans were the Turks. When the Turkish ruled this area for about four centuries. And there were no major boundaries in this whole area. But this is the little area, the tiny little area here, that we're talking about, and some people mentioned the distances. It's amazing. The area we're talking about is bordered between the Mediterranean and really the Jordan River. And up in the north, that's 40 miles across, something like that. It's not that big, and you know, maybe 100 miles north to south. It's a tiny little area.
About the size of Maryland.
Yeah, okay. As far as identities, even back in the 19th century, all these people kind of felt themselves linked, and we still kind of feel that today, but it was often known as South Syria. Lebanon, Syria, Palestine were all linked together. As far as population figures, there was a census in 1897, but just to give you an idea, just in this little area here, there were over 500,000 Arabs in this area, and the Jewish population was only 21,000, just to kind of give you a comparison. And basically, that is kind of comparable to the figures that would go back century after century, really since, you know, the first centuries of the early church, when the Romans expelled Jews from Jerusalem, and they moved further north, first in Galilee, and then out. A very small number of Jews in that area. If you compare that map, this is a map between World War I and World War II. What you see here by the key here is the Ottoman Empire was the place for European colonialism. And the whole thing is divided up. And part of that, on the other map, I had there were different interests here, but over here in Iran is where oil was discovered in the late 1800s, just almost at the turn of the century. And one of the very interesting bits of information, the power, none of this happened before oil was discovered. But and I think it was 1912 or 1913, the British Empire, with their massive fleet, made a complete changeover from steam power to oil power as soon as that happened. And they were totally dependent on these kind of resources. And so the British had a great interest in this particular area. And when World War I broke out, if you kind of remember who was on what side, you know, the Turks were allied with Germany. And the interest of people like the British was to, you know, of course, to defeat the Germans, but defeat the Turks. And one of the things they encouraged was uprisings by the Arab people against this Turkish government. And British planes flew over this whole area, dropping leaflets in Arabic, saying, basically, revolt from the Turks, and we'll do everything we can to help you gain your own statehood, your own independence. That was the message that came out. The complicating thing is, while the British were making promises to the Arabs, they were making promises to the Jewish people as well. And in 1917, there's this document called the Balfour Declaration, in which the British made promise to Jewish groups in Europe that if they got control of this land, they would also allow Jewish people to move into this area that we call Palestine.
To create a Jewish homeland.
To create a Jewish
homeland. The wording is really important. It wasn't a Jewish state, a Jewish homeland.
So there were kind of two things happening at the same time. One was this idea of moving towards nationalism and encouraging Arab people for self-rule, but also being concerned about the Jewish people and really the problem, the European problem in Europe, the problem that Europeans had a hard time getting along with Jews. And of course, the late 1800s were all the pogroms in Russia where, 2 million Russian Jews immigrated to the United States between 1870 and 1900, and problems in other places in Europe. And so in a way, it was kind of getting the Jewish problem off their back by creating this place. So there's kind of two movements going on at the same time. Somebody have a hand up?
I was just going to ask about the motive for the Balfour Declaration. Was it?
Well, that was part, and part of it was the concern about the Jewish problem from a European standpoint. There's also been some interesting stuff, and I think that Sennett has a big section in his book, or is it Wagner in his book, that there's a lot of the British rulers at that time were fundamentalist Christians. We're starting to read the Bible in the view that, well, this land was promised to the Jewish people. And there were some very powerful figures in the British government that started looking at that kind of view. So I mean, those are two factors there that were involved. But what happens is you do get more Jews moving in this area, and you do get Arabs revolting, and the Ottoman Empire is destroyed. But instead of the Arabs getting their own countries, basically the British have this area, the French this area. The French then in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq, those borders were all established there in the 1930s and all. But then this one little area called Palestine, this small little area, population shifted a little bit. These are a couple maps from the 1940s. And the next two maps I'm going to show you are population distribution maps of this area that's called Palestine. These were maps that became official documents in the UN proposal to do the partition. In 1947, the British kind of threw up their hands for ruling this area because of terrorists. The terrorists were so bad, the British were suffering, except the terrorists were Jewish terrorists who were blowing up hotels, bombs in movie theaters, and things like that. There were also Arab attacks against Jews as well. But interestingly, the Jews were attacking the British, and they threw up their hands. The United Nations took this over. First the League of Nations, then the United Nations. And they did this complete study, and there was like 17 different districts here. It shows the population. First of all, the big figures up here, by 1945, there were now 2 million. So it's about four times larger. And the Jewish population had increased, part beginning to come from the problem of the pogroms in Russia, but of course with World War II, more and more, there were quotas put on how many could come, but there were many Jews wanting to leave Europe and come here. But if you look at the figures, it's 70% Arab when this change took place. And if you look at these 17 districts, the darker color are places are Palestinian figures, each little pie, and the lighter figures are where there is Jewish populations. And if I look at it, there is only one district where there is a majority of Jewish people, and this is what's called the Jaffa. This is where Tel Aviv was established in the early 1900s. Every place else is a Palestinian majority, and if you look here, Jenin, 100% Palestinian. Nablus, 100% Palestinian. Hebron down here is 99%. Even the Jerusalem district is two-thirds Palestinian. So there's no question there's control of the Palestinians in these areas. If you look at land ownership, it's also kind of fascinating because even though it's like 30% population, for the Jewish people at this particular time, land ownership was only about 5%. They were living more in this area of Tel Aviv and small land, and most of the land was owned by Palestinians or the other here. A lot of that was church-owned land. And so the partition was put together kind of quickly. This particular map kind of shows you the whole area. The 1947 suggestion was everything that's in green here would go to the Israelis, and the rest would go to the Arab population, which included Muslims and Christians both. Everything green, Israelis. Okay? And when you look at that, the population, again, 70% Arab. What the United Nations ended up, as far as the division, was that the Jewish people would get 53%. So 30% of the population would get over half of it, over half the land. This is the area here. Remember, it's like 100% Arab populations in here. And that was given to the Arabs so that they could set up their own state, which would have been the Palestinian state. What happens There was also standing area, a lot of people forget this area came to the north too, is there was a large Arab population and strong Arab Christian population. Many of you have read L.A. Shakur's Blood Brothers. He was from this area right up here in the north. There was a strong Christian population here. That was going to be part of the Palestinian state too, as well as the Gaza. What happens, of course, is war breaks out, and there's all kinds of debates about causes of the war. But the Israelis ended up gaining from that particular war. Big surprise, everybody was worried that they'd be defeated. But they actually gained territory so that when the armistice was declared, the borders moved, and basically Israel gained another 24% of land. All of this up in the Galilee, all this area in here, and part of this down here. So at the end of the war, they ended up having 77% of the land. So again, 30% of the population gets 77% of the land.
And it's important to understand that perhaps it was the Zionist intention always to perhaps accept the UN partition, but always go for more, because what the UN was offering wasn't biblical Israel.
Right.
And for religious Zionists, that was really critical, so they wanted to expand.
Yeah.
Okay. Question. Prior to 1948 war, the area that has no color, what was that? Is that a internationalized
this,
war? Yeah, that,
this was granted by the UN to the Arab population.
And also the area surrounding the West Bank? And
this, yeah. This was part of the 1947 UN plan, but basically what happened is Israel gained that territory too.
Well, was that territory belonged to nobody in this partition plan? The green went to Israel?
No, this went to the Arabs. This was declared as Arab land.
Prior.
No, if they had accepted the partition.
Yeah, in 47.
Prior, okay.
Yeah.
But then in 48, it...
48.
Well, actually, I mean, it's interesting because this is another thing that's often very interesting, because they always talk about Israel was established in 1948, May 14th, and the very next day all the Arab countries invaded. Well, that's missing a big part of the war, because the war started the day after the UN declared this partition plan. And already, the partition plan was November 29, something like that, 1947. And already then, in November, Haifa has a huge Arab population. And the Jewish community in there starts harassing the Arab population and shoving them out. By the time that independence was declared on May 14th, Israel had basically already conquered this territory. Their armies had come in and taken over a lot of this particular territory here. And then from 1948 to 1949, basically, then they were put in the position of defending so that the Arabs didn't go on the attack. And then they ended up pulling in larger segments of territory. So that's kind of a complicated kind of thing, how that all worked. But this is where you get the name, this is referred to then as the West Bank. And here is kind of a double cross, because instead of the Palestinians getting a state, they were then attached to Jordan. They didn't even get to rule themselves, and that was the promise. So that's why it's called the West Bank of Jordan, and over here is the East Bank of Jordan. And that's why the church is ELCJ, Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, because most Lutheran congregations were here in the West Bank. Okay? Now, this area in here, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Arab people living in this territory here who got out of the way, and again, there's all kinds of debate about why they got out of the way, but they headed west and became refugees during the 1948 war. And what happens when Israel was declared a state, when peace was declared after the state, they had two quick laws that they established. Law number one was what was called the right of return, that now they had their own country. Anybody with Jewish blood anywhere in the world was allowed to return to this land. Anybody who had, I'm not sure exactly how they defined it, but anybody who was Jewish could immigrate. No strings attached. And so you end up having thousands and thousands of people moving into this territory. So that the population shifts so that it's no longer 30%, but then it moves up so that there's a Jewish majority. And they declare this is going to be a Jewish state. So that the country of Israel is going to be a democracy, but it's also going to be a Jewish state. And the idea is more and more Jews are going to get a move there so that the Jews would have the majority in ruling this particular democracy. Now, that's one declaration, the right of return for Jews. At the same time, then, Israel declared to ensure that they're going to be a democracy with Jewish majority, no right of return for Arabs. So all of those people who got out of the way, all those Palestinians here, were camped out in places, refugee camps here, temporarily waiting to go back to their home. In Bethlehem, it's called the Dehesha camp, they built a tent city. A lot of people just camping out there waiting to go back to Ramla and some of the places over here. And then the Israeli state said, sorry, if you are not in our borders at this particular time, you are not allowed back. And so people who were born here, and their grandparents were there, and they own the family, own the land, can't return. But somebody from Brooklyn, New York, who has a grandmother that was connected with somebody, it's okay. And that's what has created a great problem. This is the area, this is a map of the area, close to the area where the airport is there. If you've ever traveled in and landed around the airport, which is all Jewish territory.
Airport of Jerusalem, of Tel Aviv?
Tel Aviv. Ben-Gurion Airport. It's very cool. But this is that district. And all these little dots were Palestinian villages prior to 1948. And to make room for the new Jewish population, you have to find space for them. And so all these Arab villages were basically bulldozed. You had the big bulldoze brigade, which went through and completely cleaned out this particular area, sometimes leaving a few buildings, but something like 450 Arab villages were bulldozed over to make food for all these other people.
3,000 Palestinian or Arabic place names were.
Yeah.
Correct.
And, I'll skip over. I could go into a lot of detail there. I said I needed an hour and a half to do this. Now I lost my map here. 1967. A lot of these people who were in the refugee camps, not able to go back to their home, they then are attacking Israel. And you have people crossing the borders. And finally, Israel says, we can't have this anymore. 1967, war breaks out. And again, Israel wins the war. Israel comes all the way over, conquers everything to the Jordan, the Gaza, actually the Sinai, and up here in the Golan Heights. So Israel has all of this area, 100% of this area. Now, this is a major problem because Israel has declared itself to be a Jewish state. Israel has declared itself to be a democracy. And this is the thing the United States government, this is our democratic friend in the Middle East. If they are a democracy, what's the first thing the population gets to do?
Vote.
Okay. Those Arabs who were here in 48 do get to vote. It's 15-20%, something like that. But the Arab people in the West Bank or in the Gaza, were never given the right to vote after 1967. The democracy disappeared. And that continued from 1967 up to the 1990s. No vote, yet the Arab population was taxed. And they were a people really without a land, even though they were living there. And even Abba Ibn, who was the well-respected Israeli diplomat, always used to say, well, the situation was, it was like a marriage. And one of these marriages where, well, we really didn't want the bride, but we wanted the dowry. And with the, we wanted the land, but the Palestinians were the bride. And so how can we accept the bride? We've got to have the land. And that's how things got more and more difficult for the Palestinians. And so the Intifada breaks out as the Palestinians say, wait a minute, you know, give us some kind of rights. Oslo is developed. Can we go into Oslo?
Well, at least to get the idea of the chunking out, you know, this little puddles.
Okay, do you mind me?
We're okay to stay if you want to continue to talk. Yeah, we can stay.
Okay. When everybody leaves, I'll take the hint. Okay. Okay. So everybody understands about the problem from 67 to, with the Palestinians is, this is a democracy, but they didn't get a vote. So this is where all the Palestinians are. The Intifada, the Palestinians, the rock throwing. Intifada literally means kind of a shaking off. And so the idea is, can we shake off this occupation of this area so that we can have our own look? They have all these soldiers in here. And behind the scenes, there were all these discussions, and finally, the Oslo Accords were established. And basically, what happened in the Oslo Accords was an agreement that basically recognized the Palestinian right to the land. That basically they needed to go back to the 1967 borders.
It might be important just to say that internationally, countries did not accept that expansion in 67.
Yeah.
So internationally, it was only really Israel who said, yeah, this is now ours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically,
else,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, and I mean, even the United States supported the UN resolutions and said this would have to go back. And I mean, I do a lot of archaeology work. All the archaeological digs shut down because occupied territory you can no longer dig. And all these digs shut down, recognizing that this was only a temporary kind of thing. Oslo said, we've got to find a way for the Palestinians to get back the land. And this is very important because the Palestinians said, we agree to this, that the goal is we will accept this 23% that we showed the other map. That we will take the 23%, even though, hey, we were the majority back in 48, and we probably should have got more than 50%, but we'll accept the 23%. And this is one of the difficult things, because now, at one time, there was the idea that, well, the Arabs went to shove the Israelis in the sea. But the Oslo Accords were a way of saying, no, we accept the state of Israel to exist. And now we've got to work on this 23%. And the idea of the Oslo Accords was it was a step-by-step trust-building exercise. And the idea was, okay, if we can have a few small communities, turn them over to the Palestinians, and this will show the Israelis that the Palestinians can rule these areas, and it'll start building trust between Israelis and Palestinians, and that'll grow, and we can add more land and more land and more land. In a way, there was a genius behind it that said, you've got to be, it's not just an end of war, it's got to be trust building. That's what peace is. And that was a great idea. So first it was Jericho and Gaza, and I forgot what other cities came next, but you ended up having about 7 or 8 cities. All these that are outlined in red became what was called Area A. We were living in Bethlehem in December of 95 when the Israeli army left. And here's Jerusalem and here's Bethlehem. Somebody asked the question before. And the soldiers left. And all of a sudden, the Palestinians then ruled this area. Except, in a way, when you look at it, I mean, this red mark around it becomes a boundary. Now, that can be a launching pad to better things, but it can also be a barbed wire kind of a boundary. And it was kind of like you have all these little places that are all separated. How do you rule all those together? And the green part here were areas that were in cooperation.
I think that bell was tolling for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay.